Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Well, clearing my throat is my introduction here. Hello, folks. Again, I'm always just glad to be talking to wonderful people around the world. Do it every week. Like to remind myself every week I'm doing it. Like to remind those of you who are listening that we may be in some kind of a minority, maybe a majority in some areas of the world with ordinary rational people, but that we have a marvelous group of people around the world taking a more rational, honest, ethical look and scientific look at everything that goes on in psychology, mental health, and all the related fields. My guest today is no exception to that. His name is Red, or Richard Lawhern. Red, are you there? Red, are you there?
Yes, I'm with you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I got you. Thank you.
Okay.
We're going to be dealing with... This is not the first time Red's been on the show, and some of you may be familiar with his work. But it's an interesting, different orientation, one that would seem on the surface to be inconsistent with my views, but which is not inconsistent with my views at all. And Red has, for a long time now, 18 or more years, he's been an advocate, and he has an online and an author and an online support site for chronic face pain patients, chronic pain patients. His actual degree is in engineering systems, and I think it's often people who come from outside of healthcare who are the most rational about it when they turn their interests to it. And he's deeply concerned about the misapplication of psychosomatic medicine to patients who have valid but unrecognized medical disorders. I'm a great fan of that, too, and I haven't talked to most of you about that. I can give a really graphic example of a woman in her 30s whom I've been seeing for some time for therapy, who started to develop symptoms of multiple sclerosis. And they were the kind of symptoms, you know, dizziness, a drooping eye, a blurred vision, that in a woman in her 30s you immediately associate with multiple sclerosis. And I told her I was concerned and referred her to a neurologist. She didn't get into that neurologist, but to someone else I didn't know in the group, who told her, after getting a professional referral from a psychiatrist, that she had nothing wrong with her, it was all in her head, and implied she should be on psychiatric drugs. So it's not even just in psychiatry, but almost everywhere somebody's likely to give you a psychosomatic diagnosis when you've got a real physical disorder. And you're going to see how this unfolds in the field of pain medicine. But it gives me an opportunity to show you how, in one of the ways, I fit into the kind of critique he's going to make, because I try very hard never to psychologize physical pain, physical discomfort, or physical dysfunctions. My first thought about them is that they are real, and that's going to be the basis of the examination and our discussion. And I try to make sure that folks get to see internists or neurologists or other appropriate people. But the other way in which Red Lawhern and myself see eye to eye is that my general experience is that the opiates taken for pain and taken in the least amount possible, in other words, like you would do with any medicine, you want to give it in rational doses, that it is that the opiates are much more forgiving drugs than the psychiatric drugs, that they have less toxicity, and that long-term use of them, and I'm sure this is dose-dependent, but long-term use of them is less destructive than long-term use of psychiatric drugs. Meanwhile, psychiatry would like you to believe that you should get rid of your psyche, your pain meds, and replace them with drugs like Lyrica, which are essentially wretched psychiatric drugs, or give psychiatric drugs like Cymbalta or other antidepressants, when people are in general going to be much better off, I believe, on effective doses of the opiates. If they have to withdraw from opiates, it's certainly not going to be any worse than withdrawing from Paxil, and it might be easier. And their cognitive abilities and other abilities are likely, many of them, to be much less impaired over time. In my experience, and I do believe, and Red could speak to this, I do believe there's good science on the fact that if you compare opiate patients with patients on alcohol and patients on psych drugs, that the opiates are, again, a more forgiving drug. So I'm going to turn over now to Ray Lawhern, who's devoted his life to advocating on behalf of pain patients on the genuineness of their pain, the usefulness of opiates. So what do you think of that introduction, Red?
Well, I'm gonna try to be deserving of it. For your audience, to be clear, I'm not only trained in system engineering, but my wife is a chronic pain patient, and one of my daughters is a chronic pain patient, so I'm also invested in this field. I have a stake in it. I have, a dog in this race, because I want to be sure that my family are treated appropriately. As it works out right now, my daughter is treated with opiates and has to be, because she has just finished a neurosurgery to fuse 3 lumbar in her back, and she has Parkinson's and has been dealing with the pain consequences of Parkinson's, which is often highly severe. And interestingly enough, although I hadn't planned to speak to this, and I won't at length, she was forced to go through a process that is called fail-first therapy, or step therapy, by her insurance company, which demanded that she go through 3 sessions of rational cognitive behavior therapy before she could be authorized for consideration for a neurosurgical procedure, which was time-critical, because she was having pain as a consequence of a problem in her spine that, if it had been prolonged, could have caused her to have urinary tract and intestinal functional problems, because there's a nerve back in there that, if it gets pinched hard enough, it stops working well and people become incontinent. But the insurance company thought she had to be psychotherapized before she was going to be authorized for surgery that had been recommended by a specialist in the field. So that's one of many distortions where the psychotherapy, I won't say therapy, that's probably an overstatement, but let's say the psychogenic pain folks who believe that it's all in your head have had a very, very negative influence on policy for the treatment of essentially physical disorders. Now, that said, you and I have talked in the past in a couple of shows about some of the psychosomatic issues, but today we talked a little while ago about speaking to the issues of opioids and the problems that people are increasingly having in the U.S. with getting appropriate medical management for them. We have in this country about 100 million chronic pain patients. That's established by a study done for Congress by the American Academy of Medicine. And many of those pain patients are folks with back problems. many of them are folks with five million of them are folks with fibromyalgia. We have chronic regional pain syndrome, sometimes called reflex sympathetic dystrophy. That's a long word. We've got folks with diabetic neuropathic pain in their extremities. Just, there's a whole wide range of folks there. And out of that 100 million right now, the estimates are that about between 2.8 and 3.3 million of those people have been prescribed opiates as a part of their pain management program for periods longer than 90 days. Now, a much larger number are treated temporarily for acute pain when they have something like a surgery or a mashed finger or a problem that has to be where there's a lot of pain. It has to be regulated and people have to sleep properly. But there's reasonable likelihood that the pain is going to resolve because things will heal. Chronic pain patients very frequently don't have that option. And among the people who are prescribed opiates for a prolonged period, many of them will also be on one of the drugs you mentioned, for instance, Lyrica, or one of the anti-seizure medications, one of the tricyclic antidepressant drugs like nortriptyline or amitriptyline. Those drugs have a legitimate place in treating pain because they have a chemical cross-action on the sodium channel and on the mechanisms that create pain in response to these chronic conditions. The problem arises, however, when a patient needs opioids for a long time and finds out that under the standards that have been published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, their doctor is going to stop prescribing for most of his patients opioids, even with those that he knows can use them safely and reliably and have used them safely and reliably for years. And that's going to happen because the doctor is afraid he's going to be prosecuted by the Drug Enforcement Agency for overprescribing these medications. There is something here called an opioid epidemic, and there is a real issue with opioid overdose deaths in this country. But prescription drugs, for the most part, are not causing it. So what we've got here is a major policy crisis where the CDC has published a guideline on how opioids are supposed to be used with people who have pain for a long time. And that guideline is flat wrong. And it's not only wrong, it's fraudulent because it's based on cherry-picked data. And while it is phrased as voluntary and phrased as guidance, it is being treated as mandatory and it is being integrated into very restrictive state laws that are denying appropriate, reliable, and safe opioid treatment to hundreds of thousands of chronic pain patients. So that's the starting point for what you and I have talked about as far as proceeding with your program.
Well, let me kind of relate it to some other things that people are very aware of. I think it's very important that you pointed out that the growing epidemic of deaths from overdoses of opiates are not from the prescribed drugs. They're from people Absolutely. Getting street drugs. And in some states, I have pretty good certainty on, these deaths are related to exactly what you're saying, which is that it's getting harder and harder for people to get pain medications. It's a complicated thing. In New York State, recently, it was the last couple of years, if you're going to write a prescription for any scheduled drug, like a pain med or a benzodiazepine, you have to look up the patient online with the New York State Department and see what's been happening in regard to their getting drugs from other doctors. And then you have to put in your prescription. So the result, I mean, the aim of that is good in that you're trying to prevent people from doctor shopping. But it's also had this other effect that when people have more trouble getting medications, they get them somewhere and it's going to harm them. And I think that applies also to what's going on with you, is that we're going to see more people seeking their opiates, and we're going to outside the medical system, and we're going to see more ODs and death. Are you seeing any of that already?
Yeah, I am. I'm seeing it in patient commentaries and in doctor commentaries, and sometimes it goes even beyond that. If I might amplify on some of the things you just said, for one thing, you'll hear a statistic thrown around to the effect that last year there were 36,000 opioid overdose deaths. And if you hear somebody who's being unusually honest, you'll eventually figure out that of those, 16,000 may have been associated in some way with an opioid that could have been used in a prescription. But generally speaking, less than a quarter of those deaths occurred in people who had a valid prescription for a medical opioid. So you've got the agencies out there that are basically promoting their little drug enforcement empires, who are basically misrepresenting the cause of the opioid epidemic. And that cause is, to a great extent, street drugs like synthetic fentanyl, which is manufactured outside the U.S. and imported illegally, heroin, methadone, sometimes actually opium itself, and something on the order of three-quarters of the deaths that are involved in opioid overdose also have complicating factors like alcohol and other drugs. It's known,
oh, I'm
for
sure
instance,
they do.
That,
yeah.
You know, people mix drugs, and they add drugs. And people in really great pain sometimes do that, but it's a whole lot more likely to be a recreational use than it is a use by a legitimate pain patient, because most pain patients are very well educated by their doctors on the precautions they have to use.
Well, a lot of them
now,
go to the
signing
contracts.
Doctor training. We know that.
They're signing contracts and doing very formal things around the use of their medications, aren't most of them?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a standard that's been in place for quite a long time.
Yeah.
The problem we got with that, though, is that these people are also being asked to travel long distances in order to have random drug tests on less than 24 hours notice to be sure they don't have anything else in their systems that shouldn't be there. And that's part of the drug contract. And they're being asked to do that because doctors have been confronted by people who are misrepresenting their medical health in order to get prescription opioids for recreational use. Mm-hmm. That problem is called drug diversion. And I hear this time after time. I don't know how many times I've heard it from patients. And that is that addicts have spoiled it for real pain patients, because addicts have tried to use the systems. There's an ironic reality in all of this. This is, of course, an issue that's not new. It's been seriously discussed for probably the last generation, close to it. But it got critical in 2010 when the number of opioid-related deaths got up high enough to be pretty noticeable. And in 2009, the FDA required the reformulation of OxyContin. Now, OxyContin is one of the drugs that is used for chronic pain and for chronic and acute pain. And it was in very common use. There's an awful lot of prescriptions for it floating around. But in 2009, they reformulated the drug to make it abuse resistant. So they basically ginned up a time release version of OxyContin and replaced the immediate acting version of OxyContin with that drug abuse resistant form. There's an interesting thing that's happened since. the number of prescriptions written for OxyContin has dropped like a stone, and the number of deaths due to heroin has risen 500% between 2009 and 2014. And those two things did not happen separately. They happened cause and effect, because a lot of drug addicts who were using the system to get regulated doses of a drug that, they wanted to use decided to go after something that was cheaper, but that they had to go into the street to get, and that was heroin and other replacements. A few chronic pain patients have had to do the same thing when doctors have dropped them or refused to prescribe adequately to treat their pain. And unfortunately, just as you say, Peter, that few, I am afraid, is going to turn into many thousands, because many tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of patients are being forcibly tapered down from the doses that have worked for them for many years in many cases. They're being discharged without notice. They're being discharged without management of withdrawal effects in some cases. And I know of at least one death that is widely reported in internet sources that happened with one patient who went into cardiac arrest in his shower. I think we mentioned that in the last time we talked, because he had gone into withdrawal from being told by his doctor, "I'm sorry, I can't prescribe for you anymore. You'll have to look for another doctor." And that's very nearly a direct quote. So we have also doctors that are being persecuted, and I think that term is accurate, by the DEA for overprescription. They're being called pill mills. And what's missing in all this is that the doctors who are prescribing for a lot of patients are picking up even more patients when other doctors have left practice in their area because they don't want to be prosecuted by DEA. So what you've got is the cart is overrunning the horse here, and the DEA is creating the very problem that it thinks it's solving by trying to deny opioids to people who need them and who use them safely. It is driving these people to sources in the street, because their choice is either find somebody in the street or be completely disabled, lose your job, lose your home, lose your family. And anybody with a brain in their head is going to realize that choice is already a really tough one to ask somebody to make, just because they might have a risk of being addicted. That risk itself is very low, and there's published data that make it very plain that it's very low. So what we have here is a profoundly misdirected government policy, which is directly harming hundreds of thousands of patients, some of them lethally, because the government is trying to solve the problem they think they can find instead of the problem they have. And the problem they have is people who are using drugs on the street that are illicitly, you know, illegally obtained. You want to add something at this point before I run on too long? I'm sorry if I sound like I'm outraged, because I am.
Oh, no, it's good for you to be outraged. Yes, you're an advocate, and you're doing a great job. First, just a few things I want to talk about all this. As you're talking, I think a lot of my listeners must be thinking the same thing I am, which is this sounds like a more shoved under the rug issue than even the psychiatric drug issue in some ways.
I believe it is.
Are there any other folks who are doing what you're doing on the scale that you're doing of advocating around this issue? I know you're America. Yes. Anybody else on Mad in America? What's going on out there in terms of anybody else speaking out?
Well, I've had a couple of articles on Mad in America, and there are others that are speaking to the psychoactive drugs. And there's a real crisis going on in consonance, I think, with regard to psychiatry and psychology as a whole. As far as the opioids are concerned, I think people are a little more hesitant to get involved in the fracas, because anybody that speaks up feels that they may be at risk if they have a medical license. They may be at risk of prosecution, where they're not the prosecutors in DEA are not going to bother with getting a court order or establishing probable cause. They're just going to freeze the doctor's resources and assets and freeze their medical records and sort out who got wounded later. And when that happens, a doctor can spend years clearing his name for doing what was right, which the DEA has misinterpreted. The DEA has already lost the war on drugs, but now they're trying to maintain their empire, if you will, or at least this is an attitude a lot of patients have. They're trying to maintain their empire.
They're replacing the failed war on drugs with a war on doctors, from what you're saying.
And their patients, yes, exactly. And that when I say exactly, what I'm saying, of course, is that is what hundreds of thousands of pain patients believe. And the evidence is pretty strong that that's exactly what's going on. You know, you mentioned something about the drug databases that are maintained by New York. New York is not the only outfit that does that. Several states have drug databases that a pharmacist must consult and that the doctor must consult before a prescription is made. There is a problem with them, though. First of all, they don't cross state lines, which means they can't be very effective if you're close to a state line and you go someplace else to file a prescription. So what's happening is that pharmacists will take a legitimate prescription, even in their own state, and they'll call a doctor and say, do you really mean this? And they sometimes will argue with the doctor, even though they're not actually authorized to do this, and they will say, well, no, we don't have that much of this medication in stock. And, of course, what's ignored in that is they haven't stocked it. Not that they couldn't get it, but they didn't choose to have it on in inventory. And if there's any indication at all that a patient has seen one other doctor within the last, say, 3 months or so, then the policy is becoming that the prescription will automatically be denied by the pharmacist. The problem with that, and there are several, is that many people are retiring. Doctors do that too now and then. And when they retire, their patients have to be taken by other doctors. And if their patients have an opioid prescription, the other doctor will generally renew it. But there's no way in the drug database to recognize that that event has happened. The drug database doesn't care. So the pharmacist doesn't care. So you have a patient who has been on perhaps heavy doses of opioids. He comes to be at the end of his prescription. He comes to the pharmacist to renew. The pharmacist says no. The pharmacist three blocks over says no. And the no's keep getting bigger and louder and heavier because every time a pharmacist is contacted, they touch the system. And the system says, hey, this patient is deliberately bouncing around all over the place trying to get this drug. They must be desperate. They must be addicts. And it ain't so. So what we've got here is that sometimes the technology loses the humanity of the situation so severely that the technology itself may kill patients on these drug databases thing. And there's a lot that needs to be done to bring that technology into some more humane and thoughtful implementation.
More issues. All this, I think, is very, very good and very, very important. Just as a point of fact, you mentioned fentanyl being brought in illegally into the country. I don't know about that, but I do want folks to know that fentanyl is a legal prescription drug in the U.S. Were you
absolutely
suggesting?
And it's one of the more powerful pain relievers.
Yeah, it's a very powerful pain reliever.
It normally won't be used except in people who have really major problems with pain that can't be solved by something else.
Yeah. And then I had a question I wanted to ask, a factual question. It's my impression, and this is very much in keeping with what you're saying, that most drug overdoses, there may be no connection at all between the patient using opiates and the patients having had a pain problem. Do we have any idea what percentage of overdoses that are turning up in the country, these thousands of even deaths involving opiates as one of the drugs. How many of them actually were pain patients ever?
Yeah, there are several sources for that. It turns out Massachusetts, the state of Massachusetts, did a study of this for about a year long. It was recently published. It's been fairly widely published. We can track it down. I don't have it right in front of my face here, but the state of Massachusetts found when they backtracked the prescription database against the codes that county examiners made on pain patients, on all deaths, that about one quarter or slightly less of the people who died from some combination of opioids and other things at that time had a valid prescription for an opioid from a pain management doctor. So what you got here is that three quarters of those deaths did not involve a pain patient who was currently being managed.
Yeah.
A few of the three quarter may have been former pain patients. That's kind of that's almost impossible to find out from examining the records. But the predominant effect here is that the people who die from some combination of causes, one of which is opioids that might have been prescription, most of the time are dying from a combination of drugs that were drugs and alcohol that were used for reasons either because the pain wasn't being properly addressed or because somebody got a prescription. One of the classics here is that some 16-year-old finds a prescription and says, hey, my buddies are talking about that being a real high, goes out and gets loaded and takes some and dies of cardiac arrest, not realizing what the hell they took. That happens often enough to be a fairly serious trend in this business. So the people who are really at risk for this kind of death, a high proportion of them are teens. A high proportion of them are unemployed with a history of medical problems of some kind that may not be current. And that's pretty well established by the research that's already published.
I had another question about OxyContin. It was my impression that the original problem with the long-acting OxyContin was that people were chewing it for addiction purposes and getting the extra dose by chewing the long-acting PrEP, and that was then outlawed. Is that correct? And where does that fit into what you were saying about how the long-acting developed as a way of avoiding addiction? So I'm confused about that. Do you follow me?
Okay, what happened basically there was that OxyContin in its original formulation could be chewed, and when it was, an awful high concentration of it went into the bloodstream very rapidly.
Yes, that's what I remember.
Now, when they reformulated
it,
then they reformulated in a form where it could not be effectively absorbed all at once. It was basically time release, long acting.
Oh, okay. So they replaced the one you could chew with a long acting one, and that didn't help as much because it didn't deal with acute pain. Is that what you're saying?
Well, kind of. Let's be very precise here. The long acting variety, it's the original variety prior to 2009, was intended to be long acting, but when it was chewed, it became short acting.
Right, that's what I remember.
They reformulated
it in
such a way that even
if
you chew it, it isn't short-acting anymore.
I get you.
Even if you chew it, it's abuse-resistant.
Then why has the use of it gone down so much?
I'm sorry?
But you said the use of that new long-acting.
Yeah, it did, because an awful lot of people who had that drug weren't using it for pain. They were using it for addiction.
I gotcha. Okay. I just didn't have the steps. Now, another subject that I want to be sure we get into is the idea that's been pretty apparent to me for a long time, even before talking with you, which is that the drug companies are making a lot more money on Lyrica and antidepressants and drugs like that than they making on the opiates. And so they're pushing for these new drugs. They're pushing on the government, was the hypothesis I've thought about. They're pushing on the government to make it harder to get the pain, the real legitimate working opioids, make it harder for people to get them, so they're forced to take more junk like Lyrica and antidepressants. Is that going on? Do you think are drug companies that push the alternative drugs behind some of these government changes?
Well, like anything else, there are a few complications in that picture, but your logic is credible. The logic is in fact quite reasonable as you propose it. One thing that should also be said, though, is that most of the people who are prescribed an opioid for pain have already been managed for some time on other medications that are not opioids. Now, that's reality, and that's also good practice, because you don't want to expose people to opioids unless there is really a major need that is not being met by other means.
Well, wait a minute. Are you saying that it's better to go on to onto Lyrica than an opioid?
No, I'm saying some people are able to function better on Lyrica or on Cymbalta, but some is by no means the majority. There's no one drug response program in the human body, it turns out.
See, I'm not at all sure that Lyrica
Lyrica
Cymbalta
has some really bizarre side effects. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, hang on
we
a
also
second.
Know that if somebody takes
Fred, can you hear me?
Benzodiazepine.
Hang on a second. Are you saying that you feel, because this is so important, and I'm not sure about this stuff. I mean, I haven't made ironclad conclusions. Are you saying that you think in general, let's say somebody's had surgery, that if they can be managed on Lyrica or managed on Cymbalta, that might be a better alternative than managing them on a small dose of opioid?
Absolutely not. Because
both
Cymbalta and Lyrica take a long time to build up in the bloodstream. You can't get pain relief, even if you have chronic neurologic pain. You can't get pain relief from those drugs in anything less than 2 or 3 weeks. So opioids are the natural response over a short period for acute surgically related pain.
Yeah, that's what I think, too. And I wanted to make that clear. I thought maybe you were a little shy about just coming out and saying that other stuff is just junk compared to the opioids.
Yeah, for acute pain, that's true. But for chronic pain, the issue is more complicated than that.
Oh, well, tell me about the more complicated issue.
Yeah, well, it's complicated in the sense that most of the drugs that are used in chronic neurologic pain are used off-label from their primary purpose. The class of drugs that is used most often are the anti-seizure meds, like Tegretol or Neurontin or Trileptal. The other class that is used for kinds of pain that don't respond to the anti-seizure meds are the tricyclic antidepressants like nortriptyline and amitriptyline. And they have a legitimate use off-label from their primary use in the management of atypical forms of neurologic pain, and quite a number of patients do well on them with regulated doses and no more than required.
I believe that the doses are generally, aren't they, way below the psychiatric doses?
Exactly.
Or am I right about that?
That's absolutely true. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, what's your feeling about, is there a place for Lyrica? Is there a place for Cymbalta?
Well, what I hear from patients who use them for long time periods is that both of those drugs can have some really bizarre and disturbing side effects, especially if the dose level comes up.
Yeah.
People get lurid dreams. They sometimes even get hallucinations. Some people suffer from tremors with those drugs. In other people who use them either alone or with something like trileptal, they may be effective for a few weeks or months, and suddenly they'll stop working. And nobody really knows why they stop working. But when they do, the patient's right back in pain, and they got to do something else. There are over 70 different combinations of drugs which are used in treating the less common forms of neurologic pain, where you've got either neuralgia or neuropathy. And it's more or less a trial-and-error business. I mean, you'll see drugs from classes like the NSAIDs, the SSRI drugs are sometimes used. Anti-anxiety agents like Xanax are used. But they may be used in combination with an anti-epileptic or anti-seizure medication like Tegretol. So literally, your doctor in that situation, if you've got a really severe chronic pain, neurologic pain condition, they're going to be trying stuff and trying to see how you do with it. And it may take 6 or 8 or 10 different trials while they're trying to fine-tune the mixture of medications that might work for you. You know, there is another factor that complicates all of this for pain patients and for people who are using opioids, too. It turns out that if you have particular genes which cause you to have difficulty metabolizing, that's breaking down an opioid or an anti-seizure med, it may take anywhere from 4 to 10 times as much of it to be useful for you. Only it's very unusual these days for pain management doctors even to test for that gene factor. But it's out there, and probably something on the order of 30 to 40% of all chronic pain patients have that gene, or more than one gene, that causes an enzyme not to operate properly that would normally be involved in making an opioid or an anti-seizure med work. So what you've got is a lot of people who, for whom some meds don't work and they don't know why and their doctor doesn't know why and the doctor isn't well trained enough to realize there's something else he has to go test for. That also really complicates deciding what the appropriate dose is going to be for a patient who actually has pain and has the indicators for pain to get effective relief. There's a kind of magic involved in all of this, I hate to say, but there's a metric that is called morphine milligram equivalent daily dose, MMEDD. And it's a way of comparing the power of opioid medication, of different opioid medications. The CDC standards now indicate that doctors should very seriously think twice before prescribing more than 90 morphine milligram equivalents per day for any patient. And in fact, the way the standard is written, if you're a general practitioner, you're encouraged to have a pain management specialist make that decision, because you've got to evaluate the balance between the benefits and risks. But the hairy part of this is that in states like Maine, there are over 10,000 patients who are taking now and working well with doses well over 100 milligram equivalents. And some of them are doing very well, or at least better than they would without, with doses that are over 400 milligram equivalents, but the CDC standards don't recognize any of that. So they're tying the hands of doctors and telling them, if you prescribe more than 90 MMED, you're abusing your patient, which is nonsense. And moreover, the DEA and people that are actually board certified in pain management, they know it. And the American Academy of Pain Management doctors knows it. And the CDC doesn't care. The CDC has found their magic one-size-fits-all solution, and they're going to ram it down our throats. And they're going to do it with a kind smile and the encouragement to go meditate to control your pain. That's about what it amounts to. And yes, I'm about mad enough to spit nails. I probably ought to be a little quieter about that.
Well, I have a few more other questions, so you can take a breath.
Go.
I'd like you to respond to the exact opposite opinion about these pain meds. It's almost an exact opposite opinion from yours, which is held by some people who consider themselves pain specialists. And that is that people who go to chronic pain clinics and get opioids never get rid of their pain. So that all you have in these clinics is returning people. And that the reason for that is that the body adjusts, and we know it does this very much in regard to most psychiatric drugs, like the antidepressants and the antipsychotic drugs and the stimulant drugs, most psychiatric drugs, the body reacts by becoming more active to overcome the drug effect. So that if that model holds up for pain, if you give an opioid, and this is also partially the mechanism of dependency or addiction, if you give a certain dose of opioid, the body responds to compensate for it, which means it's actually increasing its capacity to feel pain. And then you suppress the pain more, and then it increases its capacity to feel pain. And therefore, you're always long run in a vicious cycle where the body is actually changing the sensitivity of the pain receptors. So the pain receptors are getting more sensitive as the drug tries to make them less sensitive. And this is a model that definitely works for alcohol. It definitely works for most of the psychiatric drugs. And it's why you go into withdrawal, because the body is reacting against the drug. Well, we know the body reacts against the opiates in that it can produce addiction phenomena. But I think it's your opinion that it really doesn't, or certainly not a big problem, that giving the opiates doesn't cause a greater sensitivity and hence more pain that overcomes the drugs in a vicious cycle?
Okay, here let's walk through it step by step then, because this is truly one of those complicated messes. First of all, I would say from all of the reading I've done in medical literature and in popular literature that there are some chronic pain patients who do become dependent on opioids to sustain the absence of felt pain. Now, that's a very carefully selected phrase. The absence of felt pain basically means that they are suppressing the pain reaction that they have to whatever the underlying cause of the pain is, and it can be different. So people do become tolerant of opioids. They become tolerant of other drugs as well that are used in chronic pain. But, and here's the essential but, patients are not addicts. And that's both a strong theme line in a lot of publications, and it's reality. Patients who have chronic pain for protracted periods do not react to the opioids in the same way as people who come in and use them recreationally. The pattern of behavior of drug-seeking obsession and ever-increasing doses that people without pain very often show when they become addicts is unusual in pain patients. The great majority, and by that I mean over 90%, as far as I'm able to determine in all of the reading I've been able to do, over 90% and possibly over 95% of people who take opioids to manage a chronic pain condition will be stable on the opioid in combination with whatever else they're doing, and there will generally be something else, that they'll be stable on the opioid without cravings for it and without withdrawal symptoms for years. And the trick is finding the match between the dose level that will adequately treat their pain without driving them into sleep, really, when you get right down to it. That is where pain management gets into the act. Now, that being said, the risk of addiction, which is a different thing from dependence, the risk of addiction is not zero, but it's not high. And the highest number I have ever heard from a published study was 10%. The numbers I have heard elsewhere, and there are literature sources for this, range down to about 2%. And I'll add one more statistic. The number of opioid deaths in populations that have been studied as having been treated in opioids is less than 0.2%. And in some studies, it's less than 0.01%. So we don't have an opioid epidemic of deaths in people who are treated with this, and we don't have an opioid addiction epidemic in those people either. Did I make sense?
Yes. Let me reverse the question to try to not exactly reverse, put it in another way to look at.
Yeah.
I mean, the claim of those folks who say you don't. You know, nobody gets better in a pain clinic in terms of getting off the medication. Are there studies, and what is your take on the issue of if you had if you had 100 chronic pain patients in a pretty good pain clinic, would any of them, if they were slowly and properly tapered, end up to not actually have pain anymore if they could be tapered off the drugs?
Yeah, okay. A very valid question, and one that comes up frequently among people who don't want to take drugs, and that's an awful lot of people with pain. Very valid question. And to respond directly, tapering people off opioids without addressing the underlying cause of the pain, without addressing the injury or the inflammation or the nerve damage, whatever it was, will generally cause the pain to come back. What you're treating with opioids is your sensitivity to pain, not the cause of the pain. That is almost universally accepted. Now, the flip side to this that's nasty is if you don't treat the symptom, it will get worse, and the condition of the patient will degrade over time. Because if you don't treat the symptom, loss of sleep, elevated cardiac rates, heart rates, elevated blood pressure, anxiety, and all of those other killers will continue to act on the nervous system and to compromise it. So, in a way, the people who are making the claim that you ought to be able to taper pain patients off meds and have them be okay, they've got the story exactly backwards. So far, as far as I can detect from careful study and from talking to thousands of pain patients, when an opioid is used, it is used after almost everything else has been tried, and no therapy has essentially addressed the cause of the problem.
Right.
Opioids are a management medication, not a cure medication. They don't cure anything.
Let me ask you one more. We've got about 2 minutes left. One more critical question. What about the adverse effects? We haven't talked about that at all, of long-term opiate exposure. I mean, we have obviously the well-known sexual suppression. We have the appetite suppression. We have constipation.
Yep.
I'm not convinced that we have some of the dementing processes that we see with almost all the psychiatric drugs. I'm not sure about how much cognitive loss there is on the opiates. unless they're mixed with other drugs. So that's my general take. What's your sense of the long-term adverse effects of the opioids?
Okay, first of all, I hear about the three categories you mentioned all the time, and constipation is a big one that is a complaint. That's real. And as a long-term issue, it's something that has to be managed, and it has to be managed by somebody that really knows what they're doing, by a doctor that knows what they're doing.
Got 1 minute left, so give me a quick answer on the sexual suppression. Is that a big issue?
Yeah, it is. And many, many patients ask, will I ever again have a romantic life? Many patients ask, will I ever again feel halfway decent? Because treating with opioids, it does reduce the pain, but it doesn't reduce a lot of the other effects that people have from the underlying illness.
Yeah. Ray, Richard, I got to interfere now. We're going to end very quick. We're talking with Richard Red Lawhern, LAWHERN, PhD, in the technical arena, non-medical, brilliant, informed, dedicated advocate for pain patients. We will have you on again and again. And I try to keep track of your voluminous stuff on the internet. Folks can reach you pretty directly by going to Mad in America. Where else would you like people to go to find you?
I have a website that's called lawhern.org. It is, and it has a good number of resources on it. I can also be found on Facebook as Red, R-E-D, dot Lawhern, L-A-W-H-E-R-N.
That's great. Hey, thank you for your great good work out there. Really appreciate
it. Thanks for having
me,
Peter.
You're doing. Thank you. Bye-bye now. Bye-bye, folks.